Hello and welcome to the first in our hopefully very long-lived series of Game Changers, the new podcast that starts looking at women in game, representation around game, starting to give voice to those people who maybe aren't always heard in the game industry and in game in general. This show is going to talk to a myriad of people who are in the industry, but as we are affiliated with the wonderful Women in Game, I thought the very, very best thing to do was actually start by talking to someone who is passionate about women in game and who has done an awful lot of work to start the ball rolling over 20 years of women in game. Marie-Claire Iserman, welcome to Game Changers.
Thank you very much, Sharon. It's a pleasure to be here with you today and to have some discussions about women in games.
Fabulous. I love that Marie-Claire just laughed when I finished talking, so that's always a good sign. So Marie-Claire, you've been a part of education of the industry for quite a long time. You've had a squiggly career because we've spoken before. Would you mind telling everyone kind of how you got into this area, how you've moved through the area, and how you got to be where you are today with Women in Game?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it might take us some time.
It's fine. We have time.
A fair way. So I'll try and keep it to the point. But, you know, as a young graduate, I came out of art school. I was at Chelsea School of Art, where I did an MA and master's. After that, I worked in art schools. I was primarily a part-time lecturer. And one of the areas that I had a particular focus in was printmaking and drawing. Then I think what happened was, I am moving forward quite a chunk here, but when I had my son, you know, he started playing video games, and we played them from when he was very young, actually, invested in a Macintosh computer, and you know, we spent some time together. And then what I started to become increasingly interested in was, what was play? What was video games? How do video games relate to art and other areas, you know, other areas of culture, film, animation, literature, all those things? And I was trying to kind of join the dots up between those different things. And particularly at that time, I started to think about the role of drawing in video games, looking at the different kinds of styles, because games were becoming a bit more sophisticated at that point. You know, they weren't just pixel games. They were starting to become more representational in many ways, richer designs, richer colors. Then I also started looking and thinking about the relationship between very, very traditional art skills, like anatomy, in drawing, and its relationship to video games. So I, at that moment in time, I was running an MA at Norwich School of Art of Design in drawing. So that became a specific part of the MA, and that was drawing and new technologies, drawing and video games, drawing and, you know, it was just looking at how that relationship between traditional drawing processes and new drawing processes. At that time, Norwich had started an FDA in games. It's probably one of the first in the country, actually. And I'm not really sure if I can say this, but it's such a long time ago, I think I can. They were struggling. They were struggling with it. I just think that, you know, in theory, you know, the course handbook looked good, but the delivery of it and how to actually work with students, it was completely, at that time, there was all male staff, all male students. They were having a lot of issues on the course. And I was known as a fixer. So I was good at going into things that were broken. Yeah, and fixing them. So they said to me, Marie-Claire, you know, yeah, you've got the MA, but we think that you would be great as a course leader for this course. And when I look back at that, I think, yes, what they were really thinking was, no one else will do this, but she might do it. But because it was of genuine interest to me, I thought, yeah, okay, I'll do it. So we agreed that I would do it for 1 year. I would try and understand where the problems were, try and have a look at how to resolve them, and then I would pull out again of the program, go back to my MA. But I ended up being there for nearly 10 years. So that, you know, and I think what happened was once I kind of got in there and did the work and looked at where I thought the issues were and how I could shape it, I got very excited about it. And I think one of the first things was becoming more aware and understanding a bit more about all the pieces, you know, the business side of it, the industry itself, the relationship with other art forms and how you could bring those in, the history and context of video games. So I did a lot of work on the curriculum to try to pull all those pieces together. Bearing in mind as well, you were often getting students on the program who there was nothing in you know, nothing being taught to them at school about that. So you almost had to bring them in, and you had to, like, I designed a boot camp, which was the first thing that they did, which was about the context of video games, really. And then I also set about, you know, with a target that I was going to bring in, I was going to get more women into the program. So that wasn't straightforward, but when I did finish in 2016, I was at 60-40. So, and well, that was a student cohort, and 50-50 in the staff. And I think I felt I had achieved something, you know, and the course had a very good reputation. It still has a good reputation. And I feel really proud that, you know, I was part of that legacy. But how does that relate to women in games, you might say? Well, the thing is that I heard about women in games. I knew that they were running annual conferences. And at that time, they were sort of in hotel basements. They weren't particularly big, but they were there, and there were some great speakers. I think the very first conference, which is the 20-year anniversary conference, was in June 2004. I think the first one I went to was in 2014. And it was there then that I met David Smith, who was the founder of Women in Games. And we started to have some good conversations. I started to see a little bit more. I met lots of people from the industry. I started to see what the challenges were within the industry. And then that helped me understand what to do about the challenges within education to bring on board more girls and women. And then I think it was in 2016. I think I felt I'd done my work at Norwich. And at the same time, there was a desire to expand the work of Women in Games as an organisation. So I took quite a risk, I think, because I'd been in education for a long time. And then I decided that I would move from that into a very small, not-for-profit volunteer organisation and see if I could also do something similar, but with a different focus than I'd done at Norwich, and I wanted to build Women in Games because I knew it was really important. So I set about, I think I had the first board meeting at Women in Games, and I did a presentation about my vision for it going forward. And I was, again, quite clear about what I wanted to do, and we're getting there. I wouldn't say we're entirely there, but we're definitely getting there. And as an organisation, we've grown a lot. So that's, I mean, there's an awful lot more to say, but I mean, that's a sort of starting point. Sharon, you come in with a question, then I can drill down on any bits that might be of more interest.
But look how quiet I was, Marie-Claire. No, but it's, so something we've spoken about a little bit is that idea of identifying representation, identifying why it's important. So one of the things that part of your journey that you've just spoken about was that idea of I decided in the first year of this course that I got given because no one else wanted it, haven't we all been there, was that I'm going to encourage more women into this sector. Something we spoke about when we had a chat a couple of weeks ago was the groundwork where people were starting to look at the industry and education and start saying, well, actually, yeah, it's not balanced. It's excluding a section. What were some of the initial kind of, apart from obviously you're seeing a lot of men in the classroom as opposed to women in the classroom, so that's a basis. That's a basic. You can look at it and go, yeah, I can see that there's 20 boys and there's one girl, and that's obvious. But what were some of the steps that you took to start kind of balancing that out? And what were some of the conversations maybe that you had with some of the students coming in? Because I've had some really interesting conversations with the female students, the women that are coming in, and they start talking about the idea of, oh, there's women that teach on the course you teach on. Oh, that wasn't how it was at my college. And those conversations. So maybe we can unpick that a little bit as a starter.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, very early on, when I in that first year, I was also, like all universities, there were open days, there were events. So I wanted to put together some communications in those events to encourage any girls coming in, say, let's take an open day. So what I did very clearly was, in that presentation, I demonstrated the women that work in the industry along with the men. I represented games that women had made along with the games that, you know, are more generally made. I focused on the idea of how if you were a girl from school coming in, having a look at you know, what, that it was a welcoming place, that I was supporting all students, but I was explaining that there were certain challenges for girls and women. And I was also explaining that to the boys and the men, and saying, look, we're all, you know, let's get this together. Let's have these debates. Let's have these discussions. And I also brought into those, not the very first open day, because there weren't any, I didn't have any female students at that point, or staff, it was only me, but in the next year I had. So what I started to do then was, you know, I would say, if you've got four students who are coming in at the open day to do the talk, I'd make sure that was split 50-50. I'd make sure if we went into schools or if we went in to do anything, it was split. So I balanced everything. I don't think that I overreached. I just balanced it. And then within the curriculum design itself, I also made sure that I was looking at books that had been written by women, games that had been made by women, women who'd been there in the early years of games. So that throughout the whole curriculum, if you looked at the book list, if you looked at the game list, if you looked at any of those things, you found an equal balance of a male and female contributors. And that made a big difference, you know. And there were often, you know, talking about students, we would have very lively debates, because we would say, in contextual studies, we would have a conversation, maybe something that would go along the lines like, you know, why are women discriminated against? What has happened in the history of games? Has games been mainly male platform? ? So that we could end up having those discussions. And actually, to be fair to all the students, male or female, they enjoyed that. And actually, I think, you know, I felt very much that they supported each other. And so I genuinely feel that I created a culture of genuine exchange and allyship within that program. And that was what I really wanted to try to do. And subsequently, I have done some work with other, I've been an external examiner, of course, but also I've been a consultant in certain program developments at different universities. And that's the way that I've tried to, you know, evaluate the curriculums that have been presented to me. And, you know, I can't name the university, but there was a curriculum that had been it was an all male team. And, you know, so they developed a curriculum, but there was nothing in it by a woman, nothing. Nothing in the whole curriculum of 3 years, and all of the briefs were all full of male content. So there was nothing. So unless you were male, you know, like, okay, it was something sound like, you know, design characters for an army, a captain, a horse, right? You know, but there was nothing in it that said, well, you could design a female soldier if you like. And when we went back through it with the team, they were absolutely mortified once I pointed it out to them. They hadn't seen it, and they just said, the thing is, it's our bias. That's just, this is our knowledge, this is what we know. We had just simply not considered it. And because they didn't have anybody in their team saying, no, this isn't balanced, or we need this, or we need that, they just had ploughed on with it without really thinking. But they, you know, they spent a lot of time correcting it, and now it's a very strong curriculum. So, but you know, these are things that I think they're quite common, actually, still even now.
Hugely common, because we're still in an industry, we're still in an education pool where if you say game, you know, if you're going to apply, is it going to be a man or a woman taking that course? Yeah, you're probably going to fall towards male. And then, and it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way, isn't it? It's sort of, it's still that, I don't know how much, and I'm going to learn a little bit about women in game today, even though our podcast is affiliated. I don't know how much work goes on in schools and kind of in that direction. But obviously, if you're looking at a talent pool, it probably is something that does start at school in terms of what you're encouraged to do, to where you're encouraged to place yourself as, say, a creative, or, you know, computers are for boys and you should go and do this. A colleague of mine actually said to me that she's a wonderful artist working in some incredible sort of sectors of VR and AR and all of these things, that she's bringing all this technology together, and she said to me, like, no one said that there was a job in game doing art. Literally no one said that to me. So she sort of, you know, did that thing that we all do, and we fall into wherever we're going. So I'm just interested in terms of, it's still a problem in the sector. I mean, we can look back to certain events that happened at GDC last year. Yep. I'm not gonna dig into that. That's, you know, but we can still look at these areas, and we can still look at the way that if you identify as a woman when you're gaming online, that maybe opens you up to.
Absolutely. And the issue there is that many girls and women don't identify as women online because they're afraid to.
Yeah.
So we still have a massive issue with toxicity online. And we've been working for several years with the Brighter Market Research Agency. So we've got longitudinal research on it. And it's hard reading, actually. You know, they do a women's gaming report each year. And, you know, it's really shocking, actually, to read at this time we're still dealing with that. And as you say, even last year at GDC, that, you know, I was just thinking back to saying, you know, when I first started really working, you know, on the program at Norwich, when I started to engage with women in games, that was actually 2014, which was Gamergate. And then, of course, it's either, you know, whether it's in the workplace still, at events where there is harassment, or, you know, online, because you've got different groups, haven't you? You know, you've got players who are dealing with one thing.
Yep.
You have, you know, women working in the industry who are dealing with a certain kind of thing.
Yep.
And then so there are these different kind of groups within women in games, if you like. And I think that, again, we've talked a lot about this in the team, because we don't have, we only have empirical research and thoughts on this. But if you are a young woman and you are playing online and you are having a really bad time, and then you decide to stop playing because it's not fun,
yep,
and then you're thinking about a career, you're hardly likely to be wanting to go into the games industry when you're having such a bad time as a player. So I think there is a correlation there. And I think that people tend to, I think young women, if they experience that, then they don't want to enter the industry. They might go into another media industry, but it won't be, or creative industry, but it won't be games. So I think there's an issue there. I think within the school system, it's still quite clunky, because some schools don't have enough budget for equipment. They don't have, their teachers aren't able to get to learn enough about the subjects, you know, so there are issues in there. There are also, you know, like at GCSE, obviously you've got film studies or you've got media, but there's nothing yet fully in the curriculum around play and around games. And I think that that would make a big difference, because that would give the grounding not only to the obviously the pupils being taught, but the teachers would then be able to learn as part of their role, as part of their jobs. In our guide, Building a Fair Playing Field, there is a sphere is really a chapter, which has a report that was done by Microsoft. I think it was in the early 2000s, but they found that the age of 8 years old was when girls were becoming less interested. So you've got to get the girls interested at a certain point, otherwise they lose interest. It's a very good report, and so any of you are listening, download the Women in Games Guide and look at the education sector, which also includes lots of other good examples of work that's being done. And there is really good work being done, I think, at school level. Video Games Europe have got some really good materials for, you know, using video games in the classroom. And more schools are, you know, trying to engage with those things. But it still needs more. You know, Women in Games, we currently starting to work with UNICEF on something called Game Changers, which is for girls across the world to help them engage with technology and games. Yeah, that's why it's called Game Changers. But I mean, that's a massive, a really massive big project. I think if it gets off the ground in the way that UNICEF wanted to, I think it really will change things. So it's all happening. We're close. We're getting very close. You know, even though, you know, that feeling where something is close, but it's still
just
Yeah, but there's lots of good, look, there's loads of really good people working towards it. And, you know, I have to say, in support of the industry itself, there are also some really great companies who are doing amazing work. Again, they are highlighted in the guide because we have been showcasing the very best work as a means of inspiring others. Because I think if you can see that someone else has approached and tackled a challenge in a certain way and that's worked, then, you know you might be able to adapt that for your own environment. So I think showcasing, to me, showcasing the best and highlighting the best is better than just haranguing and only discussing the worst. And so, I mean, I'm a realist and I really don't like what goes on online. I think the toxicity is really bad and it needs sorting out. But, you know, that's one part. And then there's the other side. It's very, you know, there's a yin and yang to it. We have to call it out. I do believe that we have to, when things are bad, they have to be called out. You can't just ignore them.
No.
So,
and it's an evolving landscape, isn't it? It's if people start having these conversations and they start becoming just more aware, and you talked about allyship a little while ago and sort of starting to go, yes, you know what, we're all in this together. Yes.
Yes,
we're saying that there are these things that we need to balance. So we're not just going to look at this game with just male characters in it. And we're going to look at these other games. We're going to look at these women creators. We're going to look at male creators as well. We're going to start thinking about genre. We're going to start thinking about something I brought up in one of my classes. Say, disability representation. Like, who's seen? Who's not seen? Why do you think that is? Have you actually thought about that? And when you actually ask people to start thinking about that and go, okay, find me someone in a game who's X. whatever you want to put that, like, I'm fond of boxes, Mary Claire, whatever box you're going, find me this person, go on.
Yes.
And they'll go away, I'll find that person, and they literally do come back and go, I can't find them, there's this person, but it's not in their narrative, and it's a thing and it's there, but it's not discussed. So it's an ongoing conversation. It's this evolution, isn't it? And it's that idea of starting. And I love the fact that you're saying we're not going to just concentrate on the negative stuff, which you're right. It does need someone to be called on it. It's you need to go, do you know what? No, that's not okay. And just because a bunch of people laughed at it, that's not all right. But also, like you say, looking at these really upbeat, positive things that are being done, where you're giving space to a conversation, you're giving space to people to be empowered, you're going, here's a problem. You fixed part of it. That's amazing. So if we just like cycle back to Women in Game just for a moment, and we'll talk a little bit more about the idea of 20 years of Women in Game and the sort of the research and the advisories that are kind of coming out in this period of time, which I think are incredibly important. You've made reference to examples of good practice and all of these sorts of things. Just cycling back to kind of Women in Game, obviously Women in Game, it's a very strong stance. It's a very strong kind of message. It's women in game. This is where we're looking. But we've also talked about allyship, and we've talked about a little bit about unseen people, which is something I'm incredibly interested in, which is why I wanted to do this podcast. I mean, where does Women in Game sit with allyship? Where does it sit with kind of increasing just generally representation? Where does it sit with focusing on women? If we can kind of make it that very like broad brush, cards on the table.
Yeah. Well, actually, without wanting to do some sort of formal speech right now, I mean, I could just be very clear and say, okay, who do we advocate for? Women in Games advocates for all women, girls, and people of diverse gender identities, as well as transgender, gender diverse, and intersex women. Women in Games also understands and considers the complexities of multiple intersectional characteristics. Intersectionality describes the ways in which systems of inequality based on gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender identity, disability, class, and other forms of discrimination intersect. So, for example, a combination of age, disability, social and economic status, ethnicity, and race are a problem for everyone, but can create particular complex challenges and barriers for women. Now, that is a statement that is in our statements document. So Women in Games has spent some time strategically, you know, forming a series and set of statements to be very clear about who we are, what we do. And that is one of the statements. So, you know, forgive me for reading it as if it was a lecture, but just thought it was useful to do that because we have thought very long and hard about that, and what the parameters are, how wide we can go, what our focus is, why. I think it's about being meaningful as well, like thinking about things more deeply, because what I see a lot of virtue signaling online, and I see people, you know, saying this, and then I look, but they're not actually doing anything. All they're doing is commenting, or they are, you know, virtue signaling. And I don't like that. And I think as an organization, we've said very clearly, we this is what we stand for, and these are the things we actually do. So we are doers, we are activists, we take action, we want to make impacts, because just talking won't solve it. I mean, having conversations about things is very important, but from the conversations you have to then extract those ideas, then you have to make them into tangible actions, which will then ultimately, you hope, have impact, and then you measure that impact. So, you know, that's the way we've been working as an organization. And I think to your point as well, we've been, you know, in terms of community, our community is extremely important to us. So whilst that we do focus on policy and research and, a variety of other areas, education, we also made a decision that we built this community, and that community has a life of its own and an energy. And through that community, we are making actions throughout the world. So as an example, our individual ambassadors program has nearly 2,000 members in 77 countries now. Those are all allies. Anyone can become a Women in Games individual ambassador. And, you know, that community is growing within itself. So I think if you facilitate, then you get genuine action. So what we've done, again, I think that with the individual ambassador program particularly, we've facilitated something. We've given people an opportunity and a voice and confidence. We give them materials, we support people. And I think with that behind them, people are more confident to go out there, run events, go into schools, make connections with people. So the word is spreading through that community. And then obviously, as part of our ambassadors program, we have the education ambassador program, which is now growing. That's spreading, but it also connects to the individual program. Then we have the corporate ambassador program as well. So, you know, nearly 50 corporate studios, organizations, businesses across the world. And they're all working together. So with that community, we are running events and activities where those communities come together. They're learning from each other, they're sharing with each other. And, you know, finally, we've just launched our chapters and associates program. So we launched our first chapter in Asia 18 months ago as a pilot, and that's been incredibly successful. So we are now looking for launching chapters in other regions, and we have a lot of interest already from across the world. But it's a big thing for us because, you know, that's making our organization, we need to grow, and we need to sustain ourselves as an organization in order to support the other organizations. But the associate program is slightly different, and that is for organizations that already exist or are just starting up, grassroots organizations that are doing work for girls and women. And then they affiliate, if you like, and then we work together and we support each other. Because one thing that we've learned in the last few years, particularly post-COVID, is that you're much stronger when you work together. So if you have all these disparate groups who are doing small little pieces here, there and everywhere, that is great. But if you can pull all that passion and energy together and resource it and give it a platform, then change is happening quicker because you're united, you know, you're stronger together, basically. So that's what we've been working on this last year, trying to just gather that momentum from across the world. I mean, we're just a small micro not-for-profit based in the UK, but we are having global impact. So we want to capitalize on that, and we want to make those impacts and changes, because I think we can have a better industry by those changes happening. Sorry, I got a bit on a little bit of a soapbox.
It's all right.
There.
I love a soapbox.
I know, but it's like listening to the sound of my own voice for the last 10 minutes.
No, I know. It's weird. Podcasts are weird. You're just sort of like talking away and you're, oh my goodness me. But I do need to say, but I think that what you were talking about, that idea of this, lots of people have lots of great ideas and lots of people want to do something, and like you say, that idea, and if I use the word disparate, it's not in a negative way. What all I mean is something might be going on in Yorkshire, something might be going on in Devon. Those people don't necessarily know that the other person's doing something, and you can expand that to a global system of activism, and that idea of sort of bringing people together and giving them a platform or a place. You do a lot of global conferences and global events. I've been to a few. They start at 7 a.m. and end at like 9 p.m. But again, it's about including everyone, and this idea of kind of having a space where you can sort of float your idea, get some support, someone can see how well that's gone, can maybe affiliate and do something as well. It does start to kind of spin this web of support, and like you said, community. And I'm very fond of communities. I'm very fond of the idea of sort of reaching out and saying, can I tell you something? Would it help if I gave you this? My big thing is hard-won knowledge that I've got through trial and error, and I'd rather see someone have that knowledge than go through the trial and error that I had to go through.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing as well, that in our feedback from our events, one of the things that that always scores very highly is we call them my stories, but they are where people are talking about their own very particular journey in quite a personal way. Yeah. And people just love that, because as you say, what you're often, you know, without even trying to, you are passing on really valuable knowledge just through telling your own story, because it just can ring some bells with someone else. It makes people think that, you know, even though they might be having a difficult time with work or whatever it might be, that these things can be overcome, because what they're hearing is somebody who's had a particular journey has then overcome those challenges and now is the CEO of a, you know, major company or whatever, and they're like, okay, they can do it, I can do it. And those stories score very, very, very highly at all our events. There is a thing about the personal, and I do think women are very good at that, because I think women are very good at laying a lot of things bare in terms of not being afraid to reveal their personal strengths and weaknesses.
Well, you've used the word weakness and I'll use the word failure, something that was really kind of important to me. And it's built up weirdly through communities on X. I'll give it its proper name. Ugh. But hearing people actually admit to failure, to things not going the way that they'd hoped they would go, and that's been incredibly important, because I think with any presentation situation, with any kind of social media kind of representation of yourself, there's a I'll show that I did this and it was fine and I'm brilliant. The minute someone, and this was actually someone in another area of my interest, but they basically said, I did this thing, I failed like 4 years on the go. And I just, and I sort of went, oh, you failed. So now it's all right for me to fail. And now it's all right for me to tell other people that's okay. And I think that those, you were talking about like the my stories thing. I'm sure that that's, there's a part of it in there. There's a humanity where you go, you know what?
There's a humanity.
I tried this and it went completely wrong, but I bounced back and I did these things. And I think, like you say, women are very good at going, oh, yeah, I did that. And it went wrong. Because it's not a weakness. It's
No.
positive thing. Again, it's my thing of like, let me pass this hard-won knowledge over because I don't want you to go through what I went through to get this knowledge. So let's focus on the kind of the celebratory 20 years of Women in Game. Let's go to that. I'm sure I'm going to have you back on, should you be willing to come back on, Marie-Claire. We'll talk about other things.
Yes, we have to do episodes, don't we? Oh. Focus on one specific thing so that we don't get I don't get us so sidetracked.
No, I've sidetracked you and I love kind of hearing what you've got to say, so it's my fault. I'll take all the blame. But let's go for the kind of the celebratory and the moving forwards of Women in Game, because we're at 20. Holy heck. Yes. 20 years of Women in Game. Yes. So like moving forwards, we've talked or touched very briefly on the idea of the handbook that's kind of in process, is coming out, is accessible. Yes. And if it's okay with you, I'll pop a link up to that in the podcast itself.
Yes.
So it's there. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, kind of where that came from in terms of a momentum and a moving forward and a capping of...
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, firstly, just to briefly talk about the guide, Women in Games guide, Building a Fair Playing Field. So that was researched and co-authored with Sharon Toller Annie Sage, who's one of the team at Women in Games. And for some time, Women in Games, we thought there's nothing out there. There's nothing where anyone can go to just get very focused information. And it was a big ask for us because, like I said, we're a very small organisation. So having to spend time on research and writing, you know, is big. We got some support. Video Games Europe supported us. InGames supported us. So we were able to buy out that time to do the research. It was really important, and to do it a certain way, you know, we had various conversations with people who said, oh, it's very wordy, shouldn't you just do a quick short checklist thing? And we said, no, we won't do that. It's not meaningful. If we're doing it, and, you know, some people don't like to read, okay, well, then we'll break it up into sections, which we've called spheres. And the way that you can read it is that you can just look at one sphere. So if an area is of interest to you, you just look at that. You don't have to read the whole thing. And we broke down the information within it. I think when something is complex, you can't just start making a checklist. That's not good enough in my view. So with some trepidation when it was launched, because we had that ringing in our ear that some people might not manage it because it was too much, we got incredibly good feedback. In fact, the opposite, where lots of companies, lots of people who were using it just said it was very thorough. It had really detailed information in it. It was smart. It was intelligent. And they're all the things that we had as our guiding lights. That's what we wanted it to be. And we did a lot of interviews, which we then, we transcribed. We looked at those interviews from people working in all different areas of the industry, showcases, we did toolkits, we put a range of things together. Why it's important is there's nothing else in the world that is like it. So that was a big thing. And we're now working on the second edition of that. So we're updating it. We're putting in new content because the world doesn't stay still. It's now 2.5 years old in terms of when we started writing it. And so it needs those updates to be relevant. Some things are same, but some things have shifted. A new challenge has come along. So that's where that sits. And we're hoping that this year and in the anniversary year, that by the end of this year, the updates will be completed. But of course, anything can happen. So it might not happen, but we're aiming for that. Let's put it that way. Yes, 20 years. It's quite exciting. So the very first conference, it was a conference, Portsmouth University, actually organised by a man called Mark Isles. It had some fantastic speakers, including Sherry Grainer-Ray, who did the keynote. And she wrote a book that I used a lot when I was working on the curriculum at Norwich, which is called Gender Inclusive Game Design, Expanding the Market. I don't know if you've come across it. It's still a great book now, if you look at it now. But I think what was very smart about it was at that time, the market was getting saturated. So games were being made for boys, primarily. But that was then. But then there weren't any more boys. So somebody said, "Oh, actually, 50% of the population. You might be able to get them into the market as well." So she was quite quick on producing that book and getting the industry to think about that. And I think that was a real. It was a changer, because suddenly people. That's when you started then to get more games that were thinking about another audience as well. So she did the keynote, and she's agreed to do the keynote again for us at this year's conference. So that would be fantastic to have her from the first one to the 20th anniversary. Those conferences were fairly regular each year. They were led by the university, but with industry engagement. Then a few years in, and I think it would have been 2009, that's when David Smith, who was a founder of Women in Games, as it is now, actually. So that was the Women in Games conference, but the actual not-for-profit was set up then. And he set that up. So it's quite interesting that it was two men at the beginning who saw that something needed to be done for women. And those conferences were annual. A big shift happened with COVID, because suddenly the annual event couldn't be the annual event. But we submitted for a competitive grant, which was an Innovate UK grant, which was a response to COVID grant, which we were successful at. And I am going to state the figures, because I think it's quite impressive, because, you know, they had a massive amount of businesses apply, and we did get into, I think, 8,000 applied, and 80 were given funds. But what it was it enabled us to take everything online. And, you know, like lots of organisations everywhere, everyone was learning. How do you do this? How do you do teaching online? All of these things. And so we had to learn very fast. We learned how to first principles, start completely afresh. What does an online event look like? What are the positives of it? What does it enable us to do? Yes, it enables us to reach a global audience, and it enables us to support women all over the world. So we ran the first event, which was a festival, actually, had multiple components to it. It was massive, actually, when I think about it now, but all really, you know, all really good. Going back to the point of 20 years, I think that Women in Games was primarily an events organisation, really. So it was focused on that conference and not really anything else much in between. A few possible networked events throughout the year. But again, I think that when I got involved in 2016, which is at the same time as the co-director Gemma Johnson-Brown at Women in Games, she joined at the same time, and we were very aligned in our thinking about doing more. I think that we thought there was more to be done than just doing an annual conference. So that's when we set about thinking about all of the things we could do in building the community. So the events do matter now, and we run a lot of events across the year. We run two careers networking events. We run an ambassadors only gathering. We have our conference, and, you know, we've just started monthly social gatherings. And we had our first one last week, and it was great. It's just a space. It's a very safe space for people to come in and network with each other, potentially work with each other, gain insights from each other. But the organisation has come a long way with its global footprint, everything it does, with the guide, its manifesto, with a very particular strategic focus. We've got a lot more to do. There is more that we're planning. You know, we've just launched the chapters, so that's another big piece of work for us. But I think the challenges remain. Many of the challenges still remain. So if we go full back, circle back, to the 50-50, like, you know, 50% of the population, women, 50% of players, women, across girls and women, approximately, they vary country to country, to 23% average of women working in the industry across the world, different in different countries. You know, the Nordic region's much higher, much better. Some countries lower, not so good. So even some countries in Europe down at sort of 16%. That's low. I mean, that's hot, less than half on average of the population and the player base. And within that 23%, there are still challenges within that. There are still not enough women leading studios, not enough women getting investment. I mean, there's work going on. You know, women are just still not getting, there's a lot of bias in investment, and that's holding, I think that's holding women back. Women are not in senior positions in studios. Often there aren't any. Women are still tending to do the traditional roles that women would do. HR, marketing. These are great, and women are great at those roles, but it's to do with the, you know, the biases that are then taking place at these different levels. Because if you don't have a balance, you don't have that voice in there, you don't have the direction of the organization, it's not going to, you know, some companies, if they haven't got any women at the top, they're not even acknowledging the challenges, because doesn't matter to them,
because they don't need to. Yeah, it's not their problem.
No. So I think it's, for me, some of the bigger areas is obviously equality and fairness of working conditions, of pay, of position, of opportunity. I think that's still problematic. I think toxicity and harassment in the workplace and online, the continuation of that, to me, is a big issue. So, I mean, those are the two of the biggest areas. We have 12 priority areas, but I think that for me, those are the two that are still really standing out, because they're not moving very much. Mm. They're still not moving. So, you know, I mean, our focus really is on fairness, you know, equity and parity of pay and opportunity. It's really quite simple, and making sure that that's happening. You know, things like addressing talent development, I mean, the skill shortages. But, you know, the skill shortage thing, I think, could be quite easily filled with talented young women if they were coming through and they wanted to come into the industry. And it's about making the industry as welcoming as possible. That said, it's a wonderful industry. There are wonderful studios, wonderful games. So I'm, you know, but against the other creative industries, there's more work to be done. It's still immature. I would say that the games industry is still immature.
I was going to say, but it's still a young industry.
It's still young.
And that's okay. Yeah. Everyone's got to grow up.
Absolutely, Sharon. Absolutely. But, you know, I feel passionately, I want it to be the best.
Absolutely.
I want it to be the creative industry. And I know that to be the best, you have to deal with all these things head on and get them sorted out. Then it will be the best.
Wonderful.
The best in the world. So, you know, part of our mission is for the industry itself.
Totally. Completely.
It's girls and women, but it's to make the video games and esports industries across the world as good as they can possibly be, excellent as they can be.
And you get that by including all of the talent.
You do.
All of the time.
You do. And making it a great place to work.
Absolutely.
And be, you know, and a great space to play in.
Yeah.
You know, you want people to enjoy playing games. You don't want people have to get death threats and rape threats and then be, you know, followed, you know, in the real world, even outside of a virtual world, which is what's happening, which is what happens.
Yeah.
And you don't want that. That's not enjoyable for anybody.
No, it's not. It's so, not the spirit of play, is it? It's not the spirit of this space in which we can kind of become anything we want to become.
Exactly.
Very much so.
Maybe AI will help with that, because I think there is some work going on at the moment, you know, about recognizing things and interactions that are taking place online and cutting things out. But the thing is that it's more than that. It's cultural, because you have to teach boys, men men and boys have to be taught that that's not the right behaviour. So this full circle takes us back to allyship. How do we get, you know, how do we teach, you know, our young people to behave well, to behave in the right way? So that's a whole other piece of work, isn't it?
And
that's
really
not just
is.
Because that's everything online. I mean, you know, video games aren't the only places where this behaviour is taking place.
Not at all. And it's, yeah, there's a lot of other resources that are there, which are encouraging certain attitudes and behaviours.
Yes.
Marie-Claire, we've done just over an hour.
I know, and luckily my computer hasn't crashed. But it's
I know.
Like,
is it looking a little bit shaky?
Yeah, it is.
I'm going to just.
Right.
could you sense me going? Oh, we've gone over an hour. Last time Marie-Claire and I spoke, we went over an hour, and her computer just died. It just had enough of me, I think. Marie-Claire.
Had enough of me. Not you.
Had enough of both of us. Thank you so much for being on the first pod. The podcast means quite a lot to me, and it means quite a lot that Women in Game have actually let me do it. Thank you for being so kind of open and honest about what the aims are of Women in Game and who this is for and why, because these are really important questions. I feel that you're going to come back and we're going to talk some more, I hope. You probably don't want to because you're sick of hearing your voice.
No. I am sick of hearing your voice, right? But be more than happy, because I think there are some focused areas.
No, there are.
Drill down, but I'm conscious of time, so you can't drill down as far as I'd like to about some things and to be able to share with people.
Not at all. But I'm going to say an official thank you so much for coming on. That's Game Changers. We'll be back next month with another episode. Who knows what we're going to be talking about then. I'm quite an eclectic mix of interesting things. Thank you, Marie-Claire, and that's Game Changers.